The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S Insurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine, the July 27, 2026 edition. Time Magazine is, as usual, bordered in red on its cover with a narrow white inner border. Time, as usual, is in large block capital lettering at the top of the cover. Today it's in a gold tone against a black background. The caption reads, "His Last Stand." And the portrait on the cover is that of the Dalai Lama. I will be reading that article to you shortly. The Dalai Lama is robed in red, or perhaps they call it crimson, and gold. He has his hands clasped in front of him as if in prayer or respect. He hasn't much hair. What I see is very short and gray, and he has very dark eyes, is wearing glasses, and is neither smiling nor frowning, but looking pleasant towards the camera. Beginning with the view, education, the same old college try by Jeffrey Salingo. Jeffrey Salingo is author of Dream School, Finding the College That's Right for You. When J. Michael Haney, Chancellor of Syracuse University, announced in June that the university was about to run a deficit for the first time in years, he was unusually candid. Enrollment volatility is widespread, unpredictable, and the new normal for even strong, well-resourced universities, he wrote. Indeed, the business model for American colleges is broken, and it's about to get worse. Photo here on the second page of a multi-story but old building that looks like it's in stone, constructed of stone. It's white or pale gray stone with a pale gray, probably slate roof. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stories, I'm counting, with some additional turrets and things that could hold additional space or maybe not usable space. Northwestern cut hundreds of positions in 2025 because of financial pressures. Northwestern, I believe, is in Evanston, Illinois. This shows either a fall or late winter, early spring day. The trees are defoliated, but there is definitely green showing in the lawn and the shrubs. The high school graduating class of 2026 is the first in a long line of smaller ones that will last through the end of the next decade. College leaders saw that coming. What they did not expect was the financial uncertainty imposed on higher education by the second Trump administration. Since last year, the White House has eliminated thousands of research grants to colleges and universities, proposed deep cuts in remaining research funding, and tightened access to student visas, leading enrollment of new foreign students at American universities to drop by more than a third. Now colleges and universities are bracing for the most consequential rewrite of federal higher education policy in a generation. July 1, provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act took effect, which, among other things, will put new limits on federal student loans. Graduate students who've helped fuel overall college enrollment in recent years will no longer be able to borrow up to the full cost of attendance. Most loans will be capped at $20,500 per year for most and $100,000 for the entire degree. Parent borrowing for their undergraduates will also be restricted to $20,000 per student per year, with a lifetime limit of $65,000. Meanwhile, the share of high school graduates enrolling immediately in college has already slipped from a high of 70% in 2016 to about 62% in 2022, even though workers with advanced degrees out-earn others and are more likely to be employed. Many who skip college or drop out do so because of financial difficulties and because they fail to see the relevance of what they are being taught. Colleges can respond to the current crisis the way they often have in the past: trim around the edges, delay maintenance, add new majors, hope the next admission cycle is better. Or they can accept that the old financial model is no longer reliable. The first step is to stop treating enrollment as a recruitment problem instead of a product one. Rather than force feed all students the same undergraduate experience, work-connected learning must become a core part of the curriculum through co-ops, meaningful campus jobs, and applied projects with employers. That does not mean turning college into narrow job training. It means creating sharper alignment around what college includes: two-year programs, certificates, applied credentials are not alternatives to college. They are essential components of it. Next, colleges need to rebuild their academic portfolios around the demands of today's job market. The flexibility modern students want and the employment outcomes their graduates are getting. For too long, colleges have measured academic strength by what they add: new majors, new centers, new buildings, new graduate programs. The next era will require the harder discipline of subtraction. Higher education also has to take adult learners seriously. Some 43 million Americans have some college credit but no degree. If they return, more than a third re-enroll at their most recent institution. A sizable share of a future market is a college's own former students. Millions more with degrees need new skills in a labor market being reshaped by artificial intelligence, automation, and changing employer expectations. Yet most colleges are still geared toward full-time residential students ages 18 to 22. Colleges will have to reach adult learners where they are. During the pandemic, many assumed students would flee online courses as soon as campuses reopened. Instead, online education has become normalized. A quarter of current students now are enrolled exclusively in online programs. Finally, colleges need to be far more transparent about value. Students and families are skeptical about broad claims about the lifetime earnings premium of a degree, especially when outcomes can vary widely across institutions and majors. In the past, colleges could say, "Trust us." Increasingly, students are saying, "Show us." The lesson is not that American higher education is collapsing. It is that the model has carried that carried many colleges through the past several generations is breaking down. The colleges that thrive in the next decade will not be the ones that make tweaks while preserving the old model. They will be the ones that redesign the model for today's learner. Next is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. It is almost time for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to face voters again. In October 2023, when Hamas broke out of Gaza and murdered hundreds of Israelis, most of them civilians, Netanyahu looked done for, responsible for the worst intelligence and security failure in the history of the Jewish state. He promised total victory in wars of retribution against all of his country's enemies, Hamas, Lebanon's Hezbollah, and their paymasters in Iran. For the past 33 months, the demands of wartime have held together an unruly coalition government in Israel, dominated by hard right and religious parties. But an inconclusive war with Iran, a failure to defeat Hamas or Hezbollah, and a falling out with Washington, Israel's essential benefactor, have left Netanyahu exposed. President Donald Trump has criticized Netanyahu for insubordination, citing his failure to fully support an Iran peace deal that the U.S. president urgently needs. Some Democrats and many leaders around the world have accused Netanyahu and Israeli forces of war crimes, which they deny. Israelis must head to the polls by October 27. Their prime minister is in real political trouble. The central issue of the upcoming election in the country will be Netanyahu's failure to deliver the clear military victories and restoration of security he promised. Millions of Israelis also remember the corruption charges still looming over him and his bid to weaken Israel's Supreme Court, the issues that roiled the nation's politics before October 7, 2023. Secular and centrist Israelis resent Netanyahu's deep political dependence on ultra-Orthodox voters who contribute little to the nation's economy and refuse military service. Others note Netanyahu, now 76, has grappled with both prostate cancer and heart disease, and many judge him no longer fit to serve. But Israel's longest-serving PM still has a fighting chance because the opposition may not successfully form a government of its own. Former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and Knesset opposition leader Yair Lapid have lost support in recent weeks to a new party led by former Israel Defense Forces Chief of Staff Gadi Eisenkot, who has gained credibility in part because his son and nephew were killed fighting Hamas in Gaza. If Bennett, Lapid, and Eisenkot joined forces, they could probably form the next government. But both Bennett and Eisenkot want the top job and believe they can win. A fractured opposition that prevails in elections but can't agree on who's in charge may be Netanyahu's best chance. He would then have a window to cut a deal, likely with blue and white party leader Benny Gantz, to stay in power. In the near term, this election is unlikely to mean much for Israel's economy, which boasts a strong tech sector and now benefits from war-related production. Markets and the currency remain robust, unemployment's low, in part because many workers are now serving in the army. A government without Netanyahu would certainly find a warmer welcome in Europe, reducing the risks of sanctions over Israeli actions in Gaza. It might also slow the exodus from Israel of liberal Israelis worried about the nation's direction and international isolation. An opposition win would not weaken Israel's determination to work with Lebanon's government to disarm Hezbollah. Any Israeli government would move toward a partial Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon while insisting on the right to strike back at future Hezbollah threats. A Netanyahu loss would make Israeli annexation of the West Bank less likely, though one should not expect any serious talk of a Palestinian state. The biggest difference between another Netanyahu government and an opposition win lies in each side's approach to a battered but newly emboldened government in Tehran. A new prime minister eager to repair relations with Washington would be far less likely than Netanyahu to launch major new strikes inside Iran. Limited attacks and covert operations would remain possible, with the focus on preparing for the next war instead of prosecuting the current one. So this election will likely be the voters' verdict on Netanyahu himself. The war has delayed a political reckoning. That delay is almost over. Turning the page to The View essay. Under the heading Nation, To Heal America, Rethink Patriotism, by Dominic Erdozan. Erdozan is a historian and author of To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America. There's a photo here. It's not real large. It's in color, except that it's really dark. It's also silhouettes. One sees a fading sky from blue to gray to white. There's the silhouette of probably a male. His back, his arms, his head are in silhouette, and he's holding a very large American flag, the red, white, and blue components of which are difficult to distinguish in this fading light of the photograph. America celebrated its 250th birthday mired in conflict. James Madison designed a system in which power would be balanced by power. But in a Donald Trump presidency, many of these checks have collapsed. One response to the resulting chaos has been a call to fight nationalism with patriotism and recover the soul of America from what is held to be a temporary aberration. The patriotism to cure nationalism idea goes back to a classic essay by George Orwell, which defined nationalism as aggression and characterized patriotism as its kinder, older brother. But if patriotism contains the belief that America is exceptional and uniquely positioned to lead the world in the ways of freedom, it's already nationalist. Too often, patriotism inhibits bold solutions to America's problems by convincing Americans they already live in the greatest land in the world. When moderates told Martin Luther King Jr. to slow down in the 1960s, caution was framed as patriotism. This notion that Americans are fundamentally good, the best and healthiest of nations, King once wrote, is the illusion of the damned. So, as a newly minted U.S. citizen, I began to look for other forms of patriotism. In the early days of the Republic, many reformers shared my suspicions. Abolitionists like Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison exposed the intimate relationship between the narrative of American exceptionalism and the original sin of slavery. They argued patriotism was more than a glaze on a flawed structure. It was the mortar. It bound the building blocks of democracy to the rotten timber of a slave empire. The Declaration of Independence said all humans were created equal. The Constitution, with its three-fifths and fugitive slave clauses, declared the opposite. For Garrison, patriotism was the force holding the nation back from its creed. Douglass agreed. For him, the view of America as the last hope of a fallen world was more than unfortunate narcissism. It was a rivet on the chains of 4 million enslaved people. Garrison lamented that patriotism once again took precedence over racial justice after the Civil War, which saved the Union, then abandoned African Americans. Jim Crow was engineered under a beaming discourse of national unity. Reformers of the progressive era shared these anxieties, yet their instinct was to revise rather than reject the patriotic impulse. Jane Addams felt Americans could take pride in the founders' anti-militarism and believed Americans should embrace the kaleidoscope of cultures within our shores. Rather than melting immigrants into a drab conformity, we should learn from them. When this newer patriotism becomes large enough, she wrote, it will overcome arbitrary boundaries and soak up the notion of nationalism. Journalists Crystal Eastman and Randolph Bourne argued similarly amid the nationalism of World War I. Militarism and nativism were two sides of the same coin, observed Eastman. The answer was a more inspiring vision of America as a nation of nations. Step onto the campus of a vivid American university, urged Bourne, and you will feel this new America, a place where friendships span the globe and internationalism is implicit. Here, or in any of the nation's great cities, are the ingredients of a better patriotism. This is an enticing response. We can and will do better together. Patriotism is a movable feast, and Adams is no less an anchor of my American identity than Madison. Reclaiming patriotism requires rediscovering the people who refuse to give up on democracy, even when they were called un-American for doing so. I'm turning now to reviews. First, a movie, an affable off-color comedy for Steamy Summer Days by Stephanie Zakarik. There is a point every summer when just about any of us could use a dose of ridiculousness. It might hit right as the kids return from camp or as you're counting the days till they go. Hottest day of the year? A dumb, breezy comedy is just the thing. Bad day at work. Maybe John Hamm in a bathrobe is calling your name. In the absurd comedy department, you could do much worse than Gail Daughtry and the Celebrity Sex Pass, in which Zoe Deutsch plays the Gail of the title, a bright-eyed, button-nosed, small-town Kansas hairdresser, engaged to her bland but seemingly devoted high school sweetheart, Tom, Michael Cassidy. With the wedding just a few weeks away, Gail offhandedly introduces Tom to the concept of the celebrity pass, in which each person in a committed partnership is allowed to have sex with one famous person of his or her choice identified in advance. Tom is not sure he's got a celebrity crush. Tilda Swinton is floated as a possibility, but it turns out he finds a candidate pretty fast. To reveal who it is would spoil one of the movie's throwaway pleasures. Crestfallen, Gail heads to Los Angeles with her bestie co-worker Otto, Miles Gutierrez Riley, for a hairdresser's conference. But her real aim is to solve her romantic befuddlement by sleeping with her celebrity crush, who happens to be John Hamm. How to find him? The guy selling star maps on Hollywood Boulevard knows how to locate the homes of Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon, forget that both died years ago, but has no idea where Hamm might reside. He does give them a suggestion, though, leading them to Ben Wang's Caleb, an ambitious, aspiring agent at Creative Artists Agency. Caleb has no idea how to find Hamm either, though he does track down someone who might prove useful, Hamm's Mad Men co-star John Slattery, who now whiles away his days of underemployment working out his aggressions by punching a forlorn-looking mannequin. The gang's rounded out by world-weary paparazzo Vincent Ken Marino, who has never been able to snap a picture of Hamm. He considers the actor his white whale. Any resemblance to the Wizard of Oz, including Gail's wardrobe of snazzy red shoes, is purely uncoincidental. Gail Daughtry was directed and co-written by David Wayne, that's W-A-I-N, a veteran of the comedy troupe The State, and also director of the 2001 cult hit Wet Hot American Summer. Marino, another State and Wet Hot alumnus, is the co-writer. The gags here are loose-limbed and knock-kneed, and there are lots of them. If one doesn't quite land, you needn't worry. Another will be coming along soon. Some jokes, including a riff on the history of the Wright brothers, feel vaguely Dada, as if Marino and Wayne had spent a long, happy stretch of aimless days drinking coffee and free associating. And there's plenty of mild raunchiness, including an over-the-top sex scene rendered in dreamy, silly, soft focus. Here's where Hamm and his bathrobe come in. The whole enterprise glows with friendly, pleasing daffiness. Best of all is Deutsch's Gail, whose sunbeam demeanor barely conceals her flirty, mischievous side. Gail believes that once she's achieved her goal of seducing Hamm, she'll be ready to settle down with Tom. Fat chance. Deutsch was marvelous, says Gene Seberg in last year's Nouvelle Vague. Richard Linklater's sprightly film about the making of Jean-Luc Godard's new wave classic, Breathless. Here she shows off a knack for good-natured, slightly off-color loopiness. In the film's early moments, Gail cheerfully explains to Otto why she and her dud boyfriend were made for each other. I finally got him to buy the cow after giving him the milk for free. Even in her exaggerated innocence, there's something delightfully unhinged about her. Any old schmuck can buy a cow. What Gail's kooky, erotic odyssey teaches her is that no one can fence her in. Turning the page to another review. This is Time Off Television. Little House in a Divided America by Judy Berman. Little House on the Prairie is contested territory. Like the Osage land where author Laura Ingalls Wilder's family squats in the novel that gives the series its title, and so many of the cultural artifacts we call Americana, it is the subject of mutually exclusive claims. When they were first published in the 1930s, Wilder's autobiographical children's books were about growing up on the frontier and offered something rare, adventure stories, whose hero is a brave girl. Michael Landon's long-running TV adaptation, which premiered in 1974, transformed Little House into comfort food, broad-minded but schmaltzy. Wilder's work has since faced criticism for depicting ghastly attitudes toward Native Americans. One character says the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And in recent years, the image of a white pioneer family in homespun garb has been impossible to separate from the reactionary trad wife trend. So loaded is this iconography that the very existence of Netflix's heavily promoted Little House on the Prairie reboot might suggest conservative pandering. Yet the series creator, Rebecca Sonnenschein, makes clear from the beginning her determination to take her retelling in the opposite direction. Within its first 10 minutes, the show introduces the Ingallses to a helpful black doctor based on a real person who also appears in the book, and a Native American family much like themselves. These characters become the conscience of a volatile community in this solidly built adaptation, which takes admirable care in depicting a girlhood on stolen land, but leaves little room for joy. The original Little House series quickly moved past the events of the eponymous book, in which the family briefly settles in Kansas on tribal land known as the Osage Diminished Reserve, situating the Ingallses more permanently in Minnesota. Netflix's take differentiates itself by devoting its entire first season to the earlier period. Charming patriarch Charles, a.k.a. Paw, Luke Bracey, rolls out of Wisconsin to seek his fortune on the frontier with a wife, Caroline Crosby Fitzgerald, who turns out to be pregnant and two daughters in tow. The eldest, Mary Skywalker Hughes, loves school and boys. On the other side of puberty is her kid sister, Laura, a spitfire tomboy brought to vivacious life by Alice Halsey. An early encounter with wolves sets the tone for a succession of hardships, malaria, money troubles, a home invasion. Although the U.S. government has yet to finalize its purchase of this Kansas territory from the Osage, settlers are already building the town of Independence. Ambivalent about leaving Wisconsin, Caroline is befriended by the officious Gemma James, Mary Holland, whose husband, Eli Michael Ho, is a railroad man. This couple represents traditional America, looking to reproduce its institutions and values and racism and xenophobia in the West. Their Victorian house looks prosperous in this dusty hamlet. The area's more diverse and less conventional residents prove to be better friends to the Ingallses. Charles builds their cabin with a kind widower and Civil War veteran, John Edwards, Warren Christie, who struggles with alcohol. Edwards' sometime companion, Rebecca Omselog, is a fiercely independent bar owner. In between saving lives, Dr. Tan, Jocko Sims, courts a shopkeeper, Barrett Doss, who's patient about settling debts. And Laura's fast friendship with an Osage neighbor, Good Eagle, Wren Zawenem Gotts, connects the girls' families. Both relatively tolerant, despite the mother's initial worries about outsiders, the households mirror one another. Yet we also get to see the Native American characters on their own. As Good Eagle's father, William Mitchell, Miguan Fairbrother, a farmer and translator, who believes chasing interlopers off his people's land would be futile, is drawn into negotiations between the Osage and the Americans. The question of the Ingalls' complicity becomes unavoidable. It would be irresponsible, if not impossible, to recreate the apparently apolitical little house I grew up with in the 1990s. Again, this is written by Judy Berman. When girls passed the books around classrooms and fell asleep watching reruns of the show on sick days. Necessary reckonings have pulled the deepest wounds of American history to the surface, fracturing the public into factions of the wronged, the guilty, those in hysterical denial. The Wilder family was itself explicitly political. The Libertarian Party presidential candidate, Roger McBride, a protege of Laura's daughter and editor, Rose Wilder Lane, inherited Wilder's estate. Sun and Shine's intentions are noble in transforming Little House into a vision of frontier multiculturalism, battling entrenched white supremacy, even if the show suggests a dubious moral equivalence between the Ingallses and the Mitchells. Its painterly exterior shots, all sun-dappled meadows and nights lit by campfire, surpass aesthetic expectations for Netflix fare. Halsey and Fitzgerald give their characters real energy and depth. But for all the many fiddle-led family sing-alongs that comprise perhaps its greatest concession to the trad crowd, the series feels a bit flat. Too many characters come across as generic nice people, leaving the Jameses to entertain us with their priggish behavior. Episodes like the Christmas set, Peace on Earth, can get so wrapped up in beatifying the Ingallses with moralizing monologues and wordless moments of wonder, they drag. Although it's been updated with a serialized plot and revisionist overtones, this little house suffers from the same cloying excesses as its predecessor. More childlike mischief might have helped, yet instead of contorting the Ingallses into the people we wish they'd been, maybe it is simply time we acknowledge theirs is not the enduring story we once imagined it to be. Now to the cover story, which is lengthy, so I will probably abbreviate it. Under the caption, World, His Last Stand, as the Dalai Lama ages, China gears up for a final assault on his spiritual legacy, by Charlie Campbell. In early June, Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, was wheeled into an operating room at Apollo Hospital in New Delhi. Spiritually, His Holiness is an emanation, or tulku, of the Bodhisattva Chenrezig, who renounced nirvana to help mankind. But his corporeal manifestation, which just turned 91, July 6, requires maintenance. This time it was a left knee replacement. While he's recovering well, that physical frailty is an alarm bell for the Tibetan diaspora. The vessel's aging, and the war for what happens the moment he leaves it has already begun. The Chinese Communist Party, CCP, officially rejects the existence of God, the afterlife, and the immortal soul. Back in 1954, Mao Zedong even whispered to His Holiness that religion is poison. But the great helmsman also vowed to exterminate the bourgeoisie and capitalism in China. And today's People's Republic of China, PRC, has more billionaires and sells more wares than any other nation in history. The party's proved as malleable to religion as to capitalism, spending billions on the rejuvenation of Buddhist shrines from Sri Lanka to Nepal. And the officially atheist CCP is now preparing to assert control over the spirit world. When His Holiness dies, his reincarnation must be approved by the central government, Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Mao Ning reiterated last July. There is precedent. When in 1995 the Dalai Lama named a Tibetan child as the reincarnation of the Panchen Lama, Tibetan Buddhism's second highest position, China abducted the boy and installed a state-backed figure instead. The whereabouts of the Dalai Lama's choice remain unknown. A vanishing that, despite China's wealth and technological advances, reveals a deep anxiety regarding its claim over Tibet's land and people, and which its leadership is using diplomatic pressure to assuage. Soon there will likely be two Dalai Lamas, one sanctioned by the CCP and another by the Office of His Holiness. Following the fate of the Panchen Lama, His Holiness decreed he will be reborn in a free country, and that his successor may even break precedent by being female. However, China insists a state-sanctioned short list of Chinese candidates will be placed inside a golden urn gifted to Tibet by the Qing Dynasty court, with the single name then withdrawn as the true reincarnation. It is total shamelessness, Geshe Lakdor, a Tibetan Buddhist scholar who for many years served as His Holiness's personal translator, tells Time. It is ludicrous because on the one hand they're trying to destroy everything that resembles Buddhist practice. On the other hand, they want to choose the reincarnation. Beijing denies human rights violations in Tibet, insisting that it fully respects the religious and cultural rights of the 7 million Tibetans inside China, and highlights how development has raised living standards in what was a backward and impoverished land. But advocacy groups and UN monitors paint a grim picture of a land systematically surveilled and repressed, and for the over 140,000 Tibetans in exile, the fear is the Dalai Lama's passing could deal a major blow to hopes of Tibetan self-rule. Some people believe we should not talk about the succession at all, but China's already planning for it. Penpa Tsering, the Sikyong, or Prime Minister of the Tibetan Central Administration, CTA government in exile, tells Time. If there are two Dalai Lamas, it will be a lifelong headache. So does China want a lifelong headache? Beijing's calculation is that discomfort would be a worthwhile price to finally end the Tibetan question. For this spiritual succession is not merely a religious event, but a critical flashpoint amid a struggle for influence over a faith practiced by almost 500 million people worldwide. While the Dalai Lama has served as an outspoken advocate for democracy and human rights, that moral authority may now be co-opted by an authoritarian superpower. It is not just a question of succession, says Robert Barnett, founder of the Modern Tibetan Studies Program at Columbia University. It is a question of whether the Tibetan Exile Project will be able to continue as an effective movement. As the glue holding together the Tibetan diaspora, His Holiness has long championed the middle way approach. Rather than outright independence, he seeks genuine autonomy and cultural preservation for Tibet under the auspices of the PRC. But a leadership vacuum could fracture the Tibetan movement, potentially giving rise to younger, more radical factions that agitate for total independence, perhaps even violently. From 2009, Tibet was hit by a wave of self-immolations when at least 159 predominantly young Tibetans set themselves on fire in protest against Chinese rule. His Holiness has never supported violence, even against oneself, though he also would not condemn the fiery deaths for fear of upsetting bereaved kin. That ambiguity stoked Beijing's denouncement of a wolf in monk's robes. Few outside China share that assessment. The boy born Lamo Tondup to an impoverished farming family was meant to lead an arcane land veiled behind the planet's loftiest peaks, but instead became the world's preeminent peace tribune, holding court with world leaders, winning the Nobel Peace Prize and Congressional Gold Medal, drawing a coterie of celebrity fans from Richard Gere to Lady Gaga. But as China's political clout has grown and old age makes travel more difficult, that global prominence has shrunk. He has not given a press interview since 2020, and those who wish to receive his blessing must generally make the long journey to his home in the ramshackle northern Indian town of Dharamshala, wreathed in prayer flags and sandalwood smoke. His Holiness officially relinquished any political authority back in 2011 to prepare Tibetans for the arduous journey they must continue without him. But in a turbulent world with conflicts from Iran to Ukraine occupying the public consciousness, keeping the cause of free Tibet alive is a mounting challenge. Amid shrinking recognition, the Tibetan exile community also faces a brain drain to the West, where assimilation dilutes their culture. While Beijing hopes Tibetans will accept the party's chosen Dalai Lama, the diaspora is fighting back. Shortly before His Holiness's 90th birthday, he started the non-profit Gaden Fodrong Trust. He stated that it will have sole authority to identify his reincarnation. Time spoke to six of its 17 members for this article. The CTA is also cementing ties with democratic nations around the world, using technology to keep His Holiness's message alive, and planning for a legitimate succession that will safeguard his legacy. Officials from the U.S. Embassy attended the Sikyong swearing-in ceremony in Dharamshala May 27, and the following month, Republican Representative Michael McCaul introduced an amendment in Congress that the U.S. government recognizes the Dalai Lama's succession as a private spiritual matter over which the CCP has no jurisdiction. When His Holiness passes away, that would be a huge loss for us and devastating for the Tibetan people, says Yongten Rinpoche, who heads the monastic ordination section at the office of the Dalai Lama. So we need to take steps to prepare for when His Holiness is not here with us. Through mandatory patriotic education campaigns, monks and nuns are required to study CCP ideology, Chinese law, and the speeches of Xi Jinping. Students must pass political exams to remain in their monasteries and publicly denounce the 14th Dalai Lama as separatist. Refusal to participate or pass these exams routinely results in expulsion, arrest, or the institution's closure. Monks and ordinary Tibetans are forced to replace portraits of previous Dalai Lamas and even traditional tongkas with portraits of Xi Jinping and Mao Zedong. In March, the CCP introduced a new law on promoting ethnic unity and progress, ostensibly to foster a strong sense of community for the Chinese nation, though critics argue it places severe curbs on minority languages, faiths, and cultures. By forcing Tibetan children into state-run boarding schools, where instruction is almost entirely in Mandarin, the state is weakening the linguistic tie that the next generation needs to read traditional Buddhist scriptures and engage in spiritual debate. If you forget your language, you lose your identity, says Jetsun Pema, His Holiness's sister, who served as president of the Tibetan Children's Villages for 42 years. Tibet is far from alone. Article 4 of the PRC Constitution guarantees equality for all of its 56 ethnic groups, though in reality the national vision hews to a Han Chinese orthodoxy, which avers a direct lineage from the early Yellow River Basin tribes. Critics see parallels between Beijing's repressive policies in Tibet and attempts to muzzle minority language and inculcate a singular identity along China's restive periphery, including Hong Kong, Inner Mongolia, Xinjiang, and indeed self-ruling Taiwan. It is the same thing, says the Sikyong. They're talking about peace, dialogue, negotiation, but China always has double standards. The Dalai Lama's body may be ailing, true, but no one should bet against the punchline belonging to the monk who never stopped laughing. China has claimed Tibet's soil, but by entrenching their identity in the free world, Tibetans can ensure their culture lives on, perhaps longer than the regime that seeks its erasure. That article was abridged, but here's a fun photo. It's in color. The Tibetan community in Amsterdam marks the Dalai Lama's 90th birthday, July 6, 2025, and it shows a bunch of children. The background's black. They must be on a stage with black ceiling, floors, and walls. But the children, boys and girls, are colorfully dressed. I'm guessing they're between the ages of 5 or 6 and 9 or 10. Some of the girls are wearing bright orange and purple and pink and blue and a gray. It's a bright gray. It's a bright silver gray. And she has a red vest-like option and a dangling red tasseled belt. The boys have bright vests too. They apparently wear black pants for this occasion, and they're wearing white shirts and brightly colored vests and bright sapphire blue and gold, and the guy with the gold vest also has some kind of a, I don't know if it's a white heron or egret or what, but it's flying across his chest. He's grinning broadly. This kid is tall and grinning with the biggest smile on his face. It looks like the children are either chanting something or singing something. There's a microphone in front of one, so maybe she's the soloist of the group. I'm going to try and count them really quickly now. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14. 14 children in line. The girls' dresses or kimonos or whatever they're called are floor length also. And here's a guy with the black pants and the bright sapphire blue vest, but he's wearing gym shoes. He's got his sneakers on so he can travel fast. So, again, that article was somewhat abridged because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.